the more clarification the citizens get, generally, it's a good thing. And again, I'd emphasize litigation is not the most efficient way to do that.
Lawmakers work to clarify campaign funding disclosure laws. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 11th of February. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, new research on fur seal populations helps researchers better understand the Bering Sea ecosystem.
From my side, that the way I thought the Bering Sea worked is not the way I'm finding it actually does.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Find qualified Alaskans to fill your company's job vacancies at Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. Alexis has hundreds of workers for you to browse through, and you can specify details about required levels of experience and other qualifications. Learn more at alexsys.alaska.gov or visit any Alaska job center. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Legislators are looking at ways to require more detailed disclosure of who pays for political advertising. The issue arises out of last month's decision by the United States Supreme Court that will allow corporations and labor unions to use their own money to influence voters. The decision involves independent campaign expenditures, advertising, and other activities that are not coordinated with a candidate's formal campaign structure. Assistant Attorney General John Patasin told the House State Affairs Committee this morning that the decision does not invalidate Alaska's ban on corporate contributions directly to an individual candidate. However, it does impact other parts of existing law.
Our laws, through the definition of expenditure, restrict corporations and labor unions from making independent communication on political speech. So our laws are certainly implicated by the case. Disclosure and disclaimer were not implicated. So where a disclosure or a disclaimer law is applicable to a corporation or a labor union, that law is still intact.
He said a corporation or a union must now be considered as a person and will be limited exactly the same as any individual who makes a private statement during an election. Such limits include a ban on anonymous advertising. However, legislative attorney Alpheus Bullard told the committee that there is no easy way to simplify all the ramifications of the Supreme Court decision. As an example, the ban on anonymous advertising can be bypassed by establishing a new nonprofit corporation to create ads and pay for their use.
If I incorporate myself as Alaska Friends of Alaskans for Alaska, that will be my real name. It's possible with disclosure and disclaimer requirements to require an entity or a corporation perhaps to disclose its top contributors so we can break through this veil of a name. You might consider some legislation in that area in terms of true sources of contributions.
Deputy Attorney General Craig Tillery encouraged legislators to continue putting together legislation giving the state's position. Although it is not absolutely necessary, he said that it's much more efficient than having questions answered by the courts.
Whether policymakers, yourself, the governor, whoever, wish to make changes, certainly that's, you know, the more clarification the citizens get, generally, it's a good thing. And again, I'd emphasize litigation is not the most efficient way to do that.
The committee will ask the governor directly to take the lead on submitting legislation giving the state's position on the changes the state needs to make. Meanwhile, the Senate Judiciary Committee next week will introduce its own bill describing what it sees as needed change in the election laws, hoping for action in time to be in effect for this year's election cycle. New fur seal research will help scientists learn more about the overall dynamics of the Bering Sea. The information might also explain why the Pribilof fur seal population is declining, while the Bogoslav population is growing. KUCB's Ann Hillman learned about the preliminary data.
Last summer, teams of researchers tagged and observed fur seals on Bogoslav Island in the Aleutians and on St. Paul in the Pribilofs. They wanted to know where the seals went to find food, what they ate, and how long they traveled. Andrew Trites, the director of the North Pacific University's Marine Mammal Research Consortium, says the information is part of a larger patch dynamics study.
Patch dynamics is trying to capture
the idea that we think that the birds and seals and whales are all trying to feed on patches of prey. And so we're trying to understand how these patches form, how long the patches are present, and how do the animals exploit them, with the ultimate goal of being able to predict down the road, should the oceans warm and the prey move, how are birds and mammals going to deal with that?
The theory is based on how other ocean ecosystems work, with patches of prey. The problem is, what they found when researching fur seals doesn't support that theory. The female seals had tags that recorded about 10,000 lines of data, where they traveled to, when they changed directions, what the conditions were at those places. Trites and others thought that the data would show animals all going to the same locations and staying there to gorge on food.
And what we've discovered so far appears to be animals that aren't gorging, but are actually grazing. And they remind me more of being like a dairy cow out in a field. They seem to be out wandering in fairly big loops.
Fur seals from the Pribilofs would forage for an average of 7 days before returning to nurse their pups, which remained on land alone while their mothers went to eat. Seals from Boguslav Island went for about half that time. The groups hunt in different locations, and preliminary data from scat samples show they eat different things. The Pribilof seals eat squid and small, young pollock. Boguslav seals like squid too, but they also feast on fatty, deep-water fish instead of the leaner pollock. That means they can get enough energy to get back to their pups sooner and nurse them more often. This may be one of the reasons why the Boguslav seal population is increasing while the Pribilof population is decreasing.
And if the females from Boguslav, their trips are half as long, they can spend more time producing more milk and giving more milk to the pups may be in better shape when they leave and therefore survive better and come back to breed and increase the Boguslav population.
Because when fur seals are weaned, they're on their own. Their mothers don't help them learn to hunt. Trite says they're like little adults who have to fend for themselves. The stronger they are when they're weaned, the more likely they are to survive the migration south for the winter and the 2 years they spend at sea before returning to the breeding grounds. Trite says the data analysis is still in its preliminary stages. The fur seal data is also being combined with other information gathered for the Best Preserved Bering Sea Ecosystem Research Project about ecosystem conditions and fish locations. But Trite says what it shows so far is unexpected.
But certainly I would say from my side that the way I thought the Bering Sea worked is not the way I'm finding it actually does.
The Best Preserved Project will run for 5 years and is currently in the middle of the third. When all of the information is combined, Trite says it might help figure out why fur seal populations on the Pribilofs are declining. Though the animals are no longer hunted, their population has dropped by 5% per year since 1998. 3.5 million fur seals lived there in the 1950s. Now there are only 650,000. The Boguslav population is increasing quickly. 15,000 pups are born per year. But that group only represents 1% of the fur seal population in the United States. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
The director of the Center for Alaska Native Health Research in Fairbanks has died. 69-year-old Dr. Gerald Mohat is being remembered today by friends and family as a great teacher who was passionate about his family and work. Dr. Mohat died yesterday at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital after battling leukemia for the past 4 years. Colleagues say Mohat, a University of Alaska Fairbanks psychology professor, is nationally known for his work with Alaska Natives and with other Indigenous peoples. Besides teaching at UAF, he was instrumental in developing the College of Rural Alaska and was the founding president of the first tribal college on the Lakota Sioux Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota. Bert Boyer worked with Mohat at the center and has known him for more than a decade. He says Mohat taught him to respect Indigenous knowledge.
We have a center that's based on community-based participatory research. And what that means is that we seek input from our participants into the design and conduct of our research, as well as sharing all of our research results with participants after we've been to a community.
Mohat was instrumental in leading the research that looked into health disparities among Alaska Natives. Boyer says Dr. Mohat liked to focus on what Alaska Native people were doing right rather than what was going wrong.
He really sought to look for information from elders to involve Alaska Native people in finding out ways to build resilience and to strengthen youth so that they would know they were important in society. And he really looked to Indigenous knowledge to move that forward. And I think it's been very successful.
Boyer says Mohat's work with the People Awakening program that worked at suicide prevention and helping people break free of addictions is a big part of his legacy.
He developed a very strong center with a lot of great faculty, staff, and students to hopefully carry on that tradition. He certainly will be missed, but at the same time, I know if he's sitting there listening to our conversation, he would say, you better keep going. This is just too darn important to stop now. So, yeah, he left that with us.
The Mohat family plans a memorial service at 1 p.m. Sunday at the Charles Davis Concert Hall in the Fine Arts Building on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, does the champ have another Quest win in him?
I came in here a few years ago, over 2 hours behind the leader in fifth place with a 10-dog team, and I won that race, so...
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com.
At news time, 12 teams have made it into the Yukon Quest halfway point at Dawson City. The latest to arrive are Dries Jacobs, who made it in about an hour ago, and Norman Cassavant, who arrived around 3 p.m. today. Hans Scott, a three-time past Quest champ, took the halfway prize gold last night by throwing down an impressive run between the last checkpoint at Eagle and Dawson. He covered the 150-mile stretch in 22 hours, 41 minutes, a likely but unconfirmed record. Four-time past Quest winner Lance Mackey and last year's runner-up Hugh Neff trailed Gatt into Dawson by 3 hours. Zach Steer and Ken Anderson were another 3 hours behind. Mackey says he isn't shaken by Gatt's bold run into Dawson and midway point lead.
That means nothing at the moment. I came in here a few years ago, over 2 hours behind the leader in fifth place with a 10-dog team, and I won that race, so...
Mackey says top three teams all have similar speed and predicts an exciting battle over the second half of the race. Hugh Neff says the two former race champions are dictating the pace.
I'm hanging out with the two greatest, most dominant champion mushers in the history of the Quest, so I'm just enjoying the moment.
Neff had 11 dogs coming into Dawson. Gatt and Mackey had 13. Mushers take a mandatory 36-hour break in Dawson where handlers are allowed to care for their dogs. Start differentials are also made up for. Gatt is eligible to leave Dawson at 6:35 tomorrow morning. Neff can go out at 9:07 a.m. and Mackey at 9:28 tomorrow. The race has still yet to see a scratch with all 24 teams that started still on the trail. Another unconfirmed but likely record in the Quest's 27-year history. More than 6,000 people, many of them Alaskans, have finally gotten refunds for airline tickets they bought 15 years ago. The travelers had vouchers or tickets for flights on Mark Air, a discount carrier that went bankrupt. Ticket buyers are only getting back about a quarter of what they spent. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
Back in the mid-90s, Stoney Compton traded his nearly $1,000 permanent fund dividend for 4 Mark Air tickets.
I had a family wanted to go outside sometime, and this would, the perfect way to do it. I think we used one ticket, and I don't even remember where we went. And we were planning on doing another trip, and suddenly it was all gone.
Compton, who lived in Juneau at the time, was among about 6,300 people left with worthless pieces of paper when the airline went belly up. The bankruptcy story is long and complicated, but here's some of the basics. Mark Air was the dream, some say the fantasy, of Alaska bush pilot and businessman Neil Burke. He began the airline in 1984, providing passenger service within the state. In 1991, he added lower 48 destinations. That drove down ticket prices when he challenged Alaska Airlines on its home turf. But it was too much of a stretch. Less than a year later, Mark Ayer filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. And while it tried to become financially viable by expanding service, it failed. By the end of 1995, it was out of business. Bad news for employees, airports, fuel companies, and of course, people like Compton.
No recourse, no recompense, no one to call up and scream at because, you know, they unhooked the phones, the whole nine yards. We felt like we'd been had.
So did a lot of people, and they headed to court looking for a lot of money. The bankruptcy judge appointed Anchorage attorney William Barstow as trustee, the person responsible for settling Mark Ayer's estate. He says employees were among the first to get what they were owed, though it took a few years.
So that would have included people that cleaned the plane, unloaded the baggage, provided fuel, the pilots, the stewardesses, anybody that incurred a cost that was not paid during the tenure of the case was paid.
The health and pension plans also were settled, as were most business debts. And then the payout stopped.
We couldn't do a partial distribution because we knew that we weren't going to get through the priority ticket holders. We didn't have enough money to get through the priority ticket holders. And because there were so many priority ticket holders, we just had to wait till we got all the dollars in the bucket before we could pay them.
And that wasn't easy. Hangars and planes, even office furniture and paintings on the wall, can be sold right away. But Barstow says other assets were out of his control.
We had some custom surety bonds that, by their nature, couldn't be liquidated for, I think, 12 years. We had some fuel rebates that we were getting from the federal government. We ended up with interest in a gold mine that we had to analyze that. We ultimately sold our interest in the gold mine.
Last year, the trustee finally tracked down and liquidated all he could find. That left about $2.8 million to be divided among the people left on the ground when Mark Ayer flew out of existence.
Those basically were the people who bought permanent fund tickets prior to Mark Ayer filing bankruptcy in April of 95.
But they're not getting all their money back. There was only enough to repay 28 cents on the dollar. And that's just for ticket holders in the bankruptcy system. Others, such as Compton, didn't know they needed to fill out the paperwork and aren't getting anything. The former Juneau resident, a graphic artist now living in Nevada, says at least he learned a lesson.
I know we weren't the only ones, and so, you know, we just took our lumps and kept on trucking. But, yeah, it was my first brush with corporate powers not doing what they said they would do. And, of course, that hasn't changed. And, in fact, it's sort of extrapolated.
Those getting checks should have received them by the end of 2009. They're only good for 90 days, so if you have one, cash it soon or put it in the bank. In Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
A new survey of the seafood processors that operate in Bristol Bay shows some substantial changes. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
The 2009 Bristol Bay Processor Survey was conducted by Northern Economics on behalf of the Bristol Bay Seafood Development Association. This is the second such survey of the major processors in the Bay, and it includes responses from 11 of the 12 processors that were contacted. Those 11 processors reported processing over 177 million pounds of product last year, which is 92% of the total production in the Bay. The lead author of the survey is Northern Economics' Jonathan King, who says the survey establishes a link between quality and higher relative wholesale prices.
A couple of the questions that we added in conjunction with BBRSDA was asking processors, is a fish that is chilled more likely to end up being graded number one? How much more valuable is that number one than a fish that ends up being graded a number two? And what the processors came back and told us was, yes, for the most part, that fish that is chilled appropriately is much more likely to be ended up or somewhat more likely to end up being graded a number one. And that number one is worth more than a number two, and that varies depending on product form.
King says purchases of chilled product from DriftNet permit holders nearly doubled last year.
What's really important to take out of the survey is that large increase in chilling was made possible by the individual investments of fishermen in RSW and slush ice systems and the efforts of the processors, BBRSDA and BBEDC, in providing slush ice. That individual and group effort is really what made that large increase in chilled product available. And if you think about just a conservative ice bonus of 10% is, or 10 cents per pound is the rule of thumb, that increased chilling in the bay conservatively resulted in an additional 2.7 to $3 million in permit holders' pockets this year.
The new survey of processors in Bristol Bay shows that the 11 surveyed processors purchased just over 63 million pounds of chilled product, which is up over 35% compared to the 46.8 million pounds purchased in 2008. The survey also shows a drop of 4% in the amount of canned product in 2009 as compared to 2008. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Haines recently served as testing grounds for a state experiment that sought to find out if Alaska-grown meat had a market in Southeast. Tara Bicknell from KHNS in Haines has more.
The Department of Natural Resources Division of Agriculture selected Ulrud's Alaska Meat and Grocery to receive its first ever shipment of beef and pork raised and butchered within state lines. Simon Ford is the meat manager at the store in downtown Haines.
Yeah, this is the first time we've been able to pull this off. And the problem is we're producing good stuff in Alaska, with vegetables and meat and whatever. But there's no transportation system set up to deliver this stuff in remote parts of Alaska, get it from one region to another.
The Division of Agriculture's Patricia O'Neill arranged the test with the help of a state grant that covered the shipping costs for the meat.
We've been working on a red meat project. We had some federal funding, and I said, hey, we would like to see if, we can market some meat in Southeast, because not a lot of Alaska-grown products go south at all. And a lot of it is because of, one, the perishability of it, and two, because of shipping costs. So we wanted to see, what are the possibilities of shipping products south? Can we overcome these barriers?
Ford says he was happy to be the guinea pig among Alaska's butchers.
She called me up and said, we want somebody from Southeast to do this and just to see how it goes. And I jumped at it. So I bought two steers and two pigs. They were raised in Delta Junction, and they were taken to a processing plant just out of Fairbanks, and they slaughtered them and broke them into quarters for us. And then they were trucked down to Anchorage.
Most consumer goods arrive in the Upperland Canal via Juneau from the Lower 48, and few, if any, perishable Alaska-grown goods are shipped to Southeast Alaska. It's just too costly to ship overland in-state.
The price was a little higher than buying traditional boxed beef out of Seattle, but it wasn't a whole lot higher. But once you factored the shipping in, it almost doubled. I had $3,500 in the meat, and then it was just under $3,100 for shipping.
According to the Division of Agriculture's research, Alaska farmers can grow enough supply for the state's residents, but it's the shipping complications that keeps the production for Alaska grown so small.
It's kind of ironic because production is limited by the market, and it's not cost effective at this point for our producers to grow more to export because the lower 48 market is so large. So it's our goal to expand markets. And another side of greater production is having more food security in Alaska, and we all understand the importance of that and to be self-sufficient.
O'Neill says the division recognized the risk that meat and grocery was taking by volunteering to sell the product and relied on Ford's relationship with customers and expertise as a butcher for their results.
We thought, okay, we want to see, yes, how fast the meat sells, what the customer's response is, what price they're willing to pay. And so we were able to say, you buy the meat, we'll pay for the shipment. We understand that this is a big risk for you. This is a risk that you might not be willing to take if you don't know what the customer's response will be and what price point will be the breaking point.
And Ford says people like the meat, which was not organic but hormone and antibiotic free, from Tanana Valley Meats in North Pole.
The stuff was in really good condition, and it was beautiful. The meat was just fantastic. And we had a really, really good response. People loved it for a variety of reasons. You know, I tried to interview a lot of customers, and, well, did you like the meat? Everybody loved it. No complaints about the meat. Everybody thought it was a good value, and there were different things that were appealing to people about it, one of which being it was natural, and another being it was Alaska grown. I got a lot of comments about, you know, well, the less dependent we are on those knuckleheads down south, the better, you know, and I kind of shared that same philosophy.
Neither the division or Meat and Grocery is planning to sell any more of the Alaska-grown meat anytime soon due to the extraordinary cost of shipping.
The problem is, at this point, you know, there's no more grant money available, so if we wanted to do this, we'd have to find a way to get it down here for less money, or it's just plain cost prohibitive for people to buy it. But in hindsight, we've crunched different ways of doing it, and there are definitely opportunities to reduce the cost of shipping.
O'Neill says the experiment is a clear message to Alaska growers that buyers are out there, and that could someday lead to more Alaska-grown products in the Upper Lynn Canal. In Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
Canada's National Energy Board plans public hearings about offshore oil and gas drilling in the Beaufort Sea as producers with leases begin to talk about stepping up exploration work. Alison Devereaux of the CBC reports from Yellowknife.
Imperial Oil and several other companies have permits to spend billions of dollars on exploring and drilling in the Beaufort Seas. But before they do that, they want to know what the rules are when it comes to safety or potential blowouts. The recession held up exploration last year, but that could change. Andrew Hudson is with the National Energy Board.
There are some companies that have expressed interest in drilling in the Beaufort. There are a number of companies who have exploration licenses to allow them to explore in the Beaufort Sea.
Rob Powell is with the World Wildlife Fund. The organization is trying to get a sense of what is really at stake here. But Powell says he'd like to see a clear survey of biodiversity hotspots in the Arctic and for drilling to happen in places that are the least damaging.
Only in areas where there is a reasonable feasibility of cleaning up an oil spill should we be exposing the ecosystem to the risk of oil spills.
The NEB will collect input in the coming weeks and hold hearings after that. Alison Devereaux, CBC News, Yellowknife.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Tara Bicknell in Haines, and Allison Devereaux in Yellowknife. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Lori Townsend from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. And by The Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state governments since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.